The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin from the relative tranquility of Singapore. We are coming to you live at through the offices of PRN in New York on this 14th day of October 2011. Well, all across America, there are cities and towns which were once prosperous and beautiful that are being transformed into absolute hellholes. The scars left by the long-term economic decline of the United States are getting deeper and more gruesome. The tax base in many areas of the nation has been absolutely devastated as millions of jobs have left the country. Hundreds of cities are drowning in debt and are desperately trying to survive, notwithstanding the recent bankruptcy of Harrisburg in Pennsylvania. Last year, city government revenues in the United States fell by another 2.3%, which is, by the way, the fifth year in a row that we have seen a decline. Meanwhile, costs associated with health care, pensions, and virtually everything else continue to explode. So what are cities doing to make ends meet? Well, one big trend that we're witnessing now is that many U.S. cities have been getting rid of huge numbers of employees. 72% of all U.S. cities are now laying off workers this year. Social services and essential infrastructure programs are also being savagely cut back in many areas of the country. The cold, hard truth is that most cities in America are flat broke, and things are going to get even worse in the years ahead. The city of Topeka has threatened to stop prosecuting cases of domestic violence. Pritchard, Alabama, has stopped sending monthly pension checks to its retirees, which, by the way, breaks a state law requiring it to pay promised retirement benefits in full. Paved roads, historical emblems of American achievement, are being torn up across rural America and replaced with gravel or other rough surfaces as counties struggle with tight budgets and dwindling state and federal revenue. Thousands of Metro Atlanta commuters have been without mass transit since March the 31st, ever since Clayton County ran out of money and shut down the county-owned C-Tran buses. According to a new report, 47% of Detroiters are, quote, functionally illiterate. The new statistics were released by the Detroit Regional Workforce Fund on Wednesday. One out of 10 homes in Baltimore is currently selling for less than $10,000. It's got to the point where even most of the so-called quiet areas of Baltimore are not really safe. Consider the following comment by someone named James, and I quote, "My wife and I used to live in the quiet part of Baltimore City." Yes, there are still a few of those. "A few years back. 6 weeks after we moved there, she was mugged at 6:30 a.m. weekday on a semi-busy street while walking to her car. That was a wake-up for both of us. The days of leaving your car unlocked or being in an urban area by yourself at night, or even daytime now, are over. We moved out of the city, but we both still carry weapons with us and know how to use them. Do I want to use them? No, not ever. But if 15 or 20 young men are approaching me, I can't go out like a punk, and in no way can I ever let my wife be put in a harmful situation again. Altogether, there are now almost 46 million people in the United States on food stamps, roughly 15% of the population. That's an increase of 74% since 2007, just before the financial crisis, and a deep recession led to mass job losses. If the recession is over, then why does the number of Americans on food stamps continue to increase and set new records? In some areas of the country, food stamps have become a way of life. Amazingly, approximately one-third of the entire population of Alabama is now on food stamps. America is rotting, and hatred and anger are growing at a very frightening pace. The country has become deeply divided, and the economy is now in full-scale collapse. Americans need to be educated about what is going on. The United States has lost a staggering 32% of its manufacturing jobs since the year 2000. And over 42,000 manufacturing facilities have been closed down since 2001. The awful politicians have lied to you. Globalism is destroying the economy. The United States should never have merged its economy with the economies of such nations as China. The only benefit is the U.S. infrastructure rotting and decaying right in front of your eyes. America is being deindustrialized at warp speed, and most Americans don't even understand what is happening. Pretty soon, even more cities are going to end up looking like Baltimore and Detroit. The mortgage delinquency rate is starting to rise once again. As jobs continue to be shipped out of the country, millions more people will lose their incomes and their homes. The world is changing at a very rapid pace. America was an economic powerhouse in past decades, but that does not mean that it will always be that way. Very dark days are ahead for America. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information quickly. The toll-free number, which I never fail to repeat, you should be probably confining it to, or consigning it, as it were, to memory. By now, it is always the same, 888-874-4888. Again, that's 888-874-4888. Please do feel free, call in. The number is open all the time and waiting for your calls. Okay, and if you wish to email me, that is also a facility which is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the address to write to is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, and GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Once again, RM@GFAWD.com. And then there is always my personal direct line if you would like to call in with questions about your personal situations, financial considerations, and other economic conundra that you may have in your own everyday lives. And for that, you can call me on an area code in Sarasota, Florida at 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. All right. A couple of other things. There is another meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group on the 30th of October. That's in 2 weeks, Sunday, the 30th of October, at the restaurant where the last one was held in New Brunswick in New Jersey. And if you would like to have information, that's, by the way, at 2 p.m. Further information can be obtained from Lou, and his phone number is 732-599-2200. In fact, if you would be kind enough to call him, if you would like to go, that would be very thoughtful of you, because Lou has to organize the right number of tables at the restaurant. We are getting more and more people at the events, and so we've had two now, and hopefully the third one will be well attended. There's lots of interesting people and interesting ideas to be had, and Lou will have some handouts for you, which I'm sure you will enjoy. So once again, Lou's phone number is 732-599-2200. That is for the next and third meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group in New Brunswick, New Jersey, Sunday the 30th of October at 2 p.m. All right, and finally, Anne very kindly wrote in to let me know that the last two sections of Meltdown, that's the four-part Al Jazeera explanation of the recent financial crisis, and it's exquisitely done. I've seen the first two parts myself. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Just go to aljazeera.com, I think it's .com, aljazeera.com, and put in Meltdown, and you will see the last two episodes if you have already seen the first two, and if you haven't, I strongly recommend that you see them. That's Meltdown on Al Jazeera. All right, well now, ladies and gentlemen, I have reached a point of problem for myself in terms of an ongoing event that I will either cover or not cover, and that is, of course, the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon, which is in full swing and growing by leaps and bounds. Now, I would love to cover this. I support it, and I believe that there is every chance that it will lead to something much more significant than most people give credit for. The trouble, of course, is, as I explained last week, there are but 60 minutes to every hour and only 2 hours to the wake-up call per week. And I have to discuss matters of varying importance, and I have some 50 topics that I can pick and choose from every week that I pass diligently before bringing them to your attention. So I have to decide whether something as permanent and ongoing as the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon is really something that I can give, devote lots of time to. I fear that it is not, and this is not for any reason pertaining to my lack of interest or support for the group. Far from it. It is that as of now, there are so many disparate groups that anything that I quote to you from any group will be germane to that group and that group alone. There is no unifying force right now to the entire national grouping of Occupy Wall Street get-togethers. And by the way, I will say that I'm very glad that at the last moment the owners of Zuccotti Park in downtown Manhattan lifted their prohibition on the occupiers to stay in the park so they may stay there, which of course makes it very difficult for the police now, because although they were given permission to return after the weekend, the police had said that they would not be allowed to bring back their tents and other paraphernalia, which now of course they will be allowed to keep because they won't be thrown out in the first place. Very irritating, in a situation which was destined to be extremely unpleasant, has been averted, thankfully. And I have to wonder what will happen when the weather gets cold, quite simply. What will happen to this group? I have a feeling that it is a kind of race against time here. But I wish them all the best. I do want to read you something from Matt Taibbi's latest column in Rolling Stone, which is a couple of lines on the Occupy Wall Street dilemma, because I thought it was worthwhile to bring to your attention. He says as follows: After a decade of unparalleled thievery and corruption, with tens of millions entering the ranks of the hungry thanks to artificially inflated commodity prices, and millions more displaced from their homes by corruption in the mortgage markets, the headline from the first week of protests against the financial services sector was an old cop macing a quartet of college girls. That, to me, speaks volumes about the primary challenge of opposing the 50-headed hydra of Wall Street corruption, which is that it's extremely difficult to explain the crimes of the modern financial elite in a simple visual. The essence of this particular sort of oligarchic power is its complexity and day-to-day invisibility. Its worst crimes, from bribery and insider trading and market manipulation to backroom dominance of government and the usurping of the regulatory structure from within, simply can't be seen by the public or put on TV. There just isn't going to be an iconic running girl photo with Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, or Bank of America. Just 62 million Americans with zero or negative net worth scratching their heads and wondering where the hell all their money went and why their votes seem to count less and less each and every year. Very powerful words from Matt Taibbi, and I strongly recommend, ladies and gentlemen, that you read the entire article in Rolling Stone. Go into Rolling Stone on the internet and just type in Matt Taibbi, and you will find the latest column. That's Rolling Stone. By the way, he does say in there what I had said last week and before, which brings me back a little bit to Pat's email, in which she finds that I have insulted the listeners by claiming that they can't really understand the issues. It isn't, and as Matt Taibbi said, it's really not a question of understanding particularly. It's just the complication of trying to get to terms with the corruption in the mortgage markets and the challenge, as he says, of opposing the 50-headed hydra of Wall Street corruption, which is so extremely difficult to explain in terms of the crimes of the modern financial elite in a simple visual. It is complicated, ladies and gentlemen. These are people who have got MBAs in finance. They have studied financial ephemera for years and years, and they have brought their expertise to bear instead of in productive, you know, American manufacturing and clean and healthy and sane business practices. They've brought it into a kind of arcane financial trickery, and it is not simple to understand. And I'm not sure that it's necessary to understand either, quite frankly. The one issue I dealt with, having been the question of derivatives, I don't think I'm going to go into any great detail about aspects of this. You can always find it on the internet. If specifically asked to do so, I will. But that's not necessarily where we come from. And as always, I must make the decisions about what I'm going to talk about. There are never any long silences, I hope. And you know, we fill the 60 minutes with as much information as we can, and I come to your questions. I'm always looking forward to your questions, and assuming that you have them and that you are to you shrink from asking them. Just got one, for example, from Susan Alexander just a few moments ago, who says, Richard, you have provided unique information and education from a unique perspective for the past 5 years. Stay true to your mission. Others are covering the Occupy Wall Street protests very well, like Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Keep doing what you do so well. Best regards, Susan. Well, thank you, Susan, very much. I appreciate the encouragement. Let me just repeat the link there for those of you who would like to follow Susan's advice. That's Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!. By the way, she was arrested, I believe, the other day, and she was actually videotaped being arrested. unbelievable what they will do. I think they didn't know who they were dealing with there, but anyway, she was, I believe, released fairly shortly thereafter, but just goes to show that it is not easy to make your point when the authorities want to intervene. So that's Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, and it comes in the War and Peace Report. So again, Susan, thank you very much for your useful information. Okay, well, I had prepared something else for you about the group, the movement. By the way, frontal assaults have not been the only tactic deployed by those who would like to see the Occupy Wall Street movement dry up and blow away. Patrick Honey, an associate editor for the right-wing publication The American Spectator, bragged on the Spectator's website about deliberately disrupting a peaceful protest at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., for no other reason than to give the protesters a bad name. How about that? James O'Keefe, the wannabe gotcha journalist, famous for his manipulative hit pieces on Acorn and NPR, has been spotted skulking around Wall Street, which sets up an amusing potential endgame for him, as he is on probation in New Jersey and requires a judge's permission to leave the state. As best as anyone could determine, that permission was never obtained. Hopefully, Mr. O'Keefe can find refuge in an Occupy Wall Street protesters' tent to avoid the judge's wrath. So, the cops are getting heavier, the agents provocateurs are out in force, and the protests continue to grow. Now is the most delicate time for the movement. If the protesters react with violence to police, the mainstream media will have the opportunity they've been waiting for to disparage and discredit the entire thing. If the fakers and disruptors in the crowd are not exposed immediately, as was the case with Howley and O'Keefe, they will paint a fraudulent picture of the movement that will likewise allow the mainstream news to create an inaccurate and unflattering picture. Well, so far so good on these scores, but the protesters absolutely must continue to do what they have been so excellently doing, no matter what provocations they are presented with. Remember, the whole world is watching you. Okay, well, I got an email from Patrick Winchester, which starts by indicating a video he wanted me to watch, but then continues as follows. I would also like to illustrate to you how right you are about regulation killing business. I am an extremely small-level organic farmer. By the way, this came on a piece I did a few weeks ago about the horrendous avalanche of regulations which seem to be destined to kill small businesses. I got quite a lot of mail about that, and this is one which actually I've had for a while. I just didn't get around to reading, so it is a little bit belated. Anyway, once again. I am an extremely small-level organic farmer, barely in the beginning stages of running a successful garden. The idea of certification and so forth sounds reasonable to people. At a practical level, the bureaucracy is not designed for small business at all, and practically amounts to extortion. To actually sell the three different groups of items that I could produce on a small plot, I need three different permits. Let's do the list. I could sell the three different groups of items that I could produce on a small plot. I could sell harvested fruits and vegetables for eating. I could sell baby plants for planting, and I could sell chicken eggs, expanding later into baby chicks as well. But for now, just the first three. For the harvested produce, I need to get a certified producer permit from the county, meaning an inspector has to come to my property and count all my plants and record everything I will be selling. I am not allowed to sell anything not on the list. meaning that if there are any changes, something fails and gets replaced, we put in some herbs, etc., the county has to be notified and my property has to be inspected again and recounted. To sell baby plants, even the plants that I'm selling harvested, I need to get a certified nursery permit. And of course, to sell the eggs, it is even more difficult. Again, an inspection and permits are required. Flock size limitations, varying taxes, etc. All of this costs money and takes time, leaving the business completely at the mercy of bureaucrats. All of this has to be taken care of before any business has been done, after all the investment in the actual business itself. Oh, and if I want to use the word organic in association with my products, it's another inspection and permit fee to both a private company and the government, and all of this is on an annual basis. It is a situation that is not conducive to real small business reviving the working condition in this country. I would be much happier if the people who run the farmers' markets could just come certify me themselves and take a percentage for the inspection costs. It would be much easier. The awakening is happening, however. It does not have to get worse before it gets better, although it likely will. Unfortunately, I hope that the warnings presented on the wake-up call, combined with the efforts of the other great alternative media sources like InfoWars, really do wake people up to the situation we're facing here and motivate action to a positive situation. Thanks, Patrick. Well, it's interesting to get this kind of feedback, ladies and gentlemen. It's very sad and very unfortunate, but this is frankly what the new all-embracing state has in store for you. And if you told somebody, as I often say to people, you know, 20 years ago, if you told them what life would be like in 20 years' time, they simply wouldn't believe you. It's not a question of whether it would or whether it wouldn't. It's just a question of offering them the concept, the idea, the vision of what might be, and they would just dismiss it out of hand. Well, the other day, I talked on the show about why this depression is going to be so very much worse than that of the 1930s. And curiously, I didn't get a single email of comment on this, although I would have thought it was somewhat controversial, and I really hadn't seen that much written on this idea. Well, right now, for a few moments before our break, which may come a few moments late, so I beg your indulgence, Matt, on this, but let me just talk about this first of all, and then perhaps we could go to our break. Let me just expand a little more on this idea about the severity of the coming depression. David Leonhardt was writing in the New York Times recently, and he had this to say, and I quote, "Underneath the misery of the Great Depression, the United States economy was quietly making enormous strides during the 1930s. Television and nylon stockings were invented. Refrigerators and washing machines turned into mass market products. Railroads became faster and roads smoother and wider. As the economic historian Alexander J. Field has said, the 1930s constituted, quote, the most technologically progressive decade of the century. It would clearly be nice if we could take some comfort from this bit of history. If anything, though, the lesson of the 1930s may be the opposite one. The most worrisome aspect about our current slump is that it combines obvious short-term problems from the financial crisis with less obvious long-term problems. Those long-term problems include a decade-long slowdown in new business formation, the stagnation of educational gains, and the rapid growth of industries with mixed blessings, including finance and healthcare. Together, these problems raise the possibility that the United States is not merely suffering through a normal, if severe, downturn. Instead, it may have entered a phase in which high employment is the norm. And that ends the quote from Alexander Field. Even the Fed is managing expectations downward. It has come out recently saying we'll have employment over 7% until after 2015. Leonhardt thinks we're following Europe's pattern, with high unemployment as a more or less permanent feature of the U.S. economy. He's probably right about that. Price inflation is giving way to price deflation. That means labor rates, which are generally less flexible, tend to be too high. If you're skilled in a particular field, you may be doing very well. But most people aren't skilled. The typical person doesn't have any real skill. When the economy was booming, it didn't matter. He didn't need any skills. Anybody could get a job, and a credit card, and a house. But now, he's struggling. The house is underwater. The job has disappeared. And he still has no skills. How much can a person like that expect to make? About as much as the average unskilled person in other countries, which is a lot less than he intended to make. Yes, yes, I know America is supposed to be an exceptional country. But there is no intrinsic reason why unskilled people in America should make more than they do elsewhere on the planet. I'm sorry, but that's real life. We're all going to have to get used to it. You want to put people back to work? Just cut wages in half. Presto, mission accomplished. Seriously, it would be easy to fix the unemployment problem. Just eliminate all the safety nets, welfare, unemployment, disability, minimum wages, and other employment legislation. Let price and demand get together on their own. Anyone who really wanted to work would lower his wage to the point where an employer was willing to pay him. The economy would boom. But that's another story, and frankly, no one other than Ron Paul is going to mention it in Congress. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, if I get some very unpleasant emails about what I've just said, I'm sorry. I fully take responsibility for this. I'm not suggesting it's going to be easy. I am suggesting that the Depression is going to force this, whether you like it or not. And nobody is going to say these things. That's the horror. It's just going to happen, bit by bit, by little bit. And you're just going to have to get used to it. This is deflation with a capital D. This is the thing nobody wanted to talk about. This is why they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to get tangled up in the minutiae of what deflation brings. But it is hell on earth. And there is no solution. House prices have got to come down to a point where people can afford to buy them. Wages have got to come down to a point where employers are prepared to pay and people are prepared to buy the resulting products at a price that they can afford. And by the way, a French economist called Jacques Rouff was way ahead on this. He realized that you would never be able to fix unemployment by rolling back labor laws. So he figured another way of lowering wages, create inflation. That, he said, was the real genius of what he called Keynesian counter-cyclical stimulus spending. It created inflation, which lowered real wages, thus putting people back to work. And that's what they want to do in government. That's why the Federal Reserve is desperately trying to keep prices high. And that's why, you know, people are talking seriously about burning houses. It's just people in this week have been discussing the concept of burning houses to keep the price of houses up. It's what they did in the 1930s. They burnt the crops to keep the price of crops high, along with all the starving people in the United States. I mean, these politicians, they have no idea what they're doing. It's not that they mean harm. They just have no idea. They have no concept of how to make things work. They never could have had. They didn't have training. How could you expect them to have? But that's what you have in a country like America, where meritocracy is not the order of the day. The best man doesn't get the job. The guy with the greatest firepower gets the job. That's the truth, and that's how it's going to work, and that's why neither of the parties are of any use in solving the problem, and that is why it's going to get grim beyond belief. And in turn, why I have suggested, in part, though I have more, even more pressing reasons to support my contention that you should be out of this country as soon as possible. But I will come to that later on, hopefully in the program if we have time, or else early next week. You know, in the 1930s, America was developing new technologies and building new industries. Yes, even during the Depression, ladies and gentlemen. What's it doing today? Subsidizing its zombie industries of the past and getting nothing from it? Healthcare is a person on medical care, is a zero-sum game. It spends fantastic amounts of money, with the United States spending at least 50% more per person on medical care than any other country, without getting noticeably better results. And some aspects of care, like certain cancer treatments, are better, but others, like medical error rates, are far, far worse. And the contrast suggests that a significant portion of medical spending is just wasted, be it on approaches that do not make people healthier or on insurance company bureaucracy. In finance, trading volumes have boomed in recent decades, yet not one penny of this activity has lifted living standards. Paul Volcker, the former Fed chairman, has mischievously said that the only useful recent financial innovation was the automatic teller machine. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's go to our break, and I will be right back. Okay, I think we're back. And in the meantime, while we were on break, I received an email from Rosemary Utica, who says, "Hi, Richard. Good to hear your comments. Would the protesters be better served if they went to the internet and various sources to find specific examples of fraud by the elite Wall Streeters and bring these to the fore? One way to expose them is with the law. Some must be young lawyers. Best, Rosemary." Rosemary, obviously, the more information anybody has, the better. And there are some very interesting people that do stand up in these groups and talk. Really interesting people, people who probably should be leaders in their own right and probably aren't for very good reasons. But I think there's a lot of information. Some of the groups, which by the way is another reason why I find it very hard to talk about them, some are much, much more alert, it seems to me, than others. For example, the Downtown Manhattan group seems to be particularly alert, but I've heard bad reports from the Los Angeles downtown group, which seems to be very frivolous, judging by what I've heard. I don't know if it's true. I can sure there are plenty of people who will tell me they've heard maybe good things about it as well, but the general tenor seems to be that the various groups have their own kind of inbuilt character or personality, and they go for what they with the flow, as it were. I think, as I said, Rosemary, the more information that you can get off the internet, the more people that could put forward that information, the better. Always being mindful that you don't want to get starry-eyed about this. I mean, there is a limit to what people can do right now as they protest. The real change comes at a point in the future that we're not necessarily aware of right now. And then again, when you have people with a lot of information who are very voluble, who can really enunciate the issues, you have a lot of power at that point. And there are certain numbers of even mainstream reporters who are going down to these groups and picking stuff up and coming back and reporting. It is a very good thing. Yes, I hope that people will do that. If you bring some lawyers along, that would be good. Historians, sociologists, anybody who can lend a hand is going to do well. I have no question about that. One other thing that I will do as a sort of service to the Occupy Wall Street gatherings, maybe this weekend if some of you are going down, thought I'd just give you a couple of things you might want to bring up if you have a chance. On Monday, I mentioned the FASB Rule 57, which permitted banks to lie about the valuation of their holdings. You might want to talk about that. Here are a couple of other things. The Federal Reserve's purchases of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's debt obligations were illegal. Beginning in 2009, the Federal Reserve began buying nearly $1.5 trillion in obligations of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, both of which were insolvent and in government receivership. The Fed justified these purchases by appealing to Section 14.2 of the Federal Reserve Act, which allows the Fed to purchase securities which are, quote, a direct obligation of or fully guaranteed as to principal and interest by any agency of the United States, end of quote. Now, Ginnie Mae, the financing arm of the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, is a bona fide government agency. So there would have been no legal problem if the Fed had purchased Ginnie Mae's. In contrast, however, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were not and are not U.S. government agencies, nor are the obligations held by the Fed fully guaranteed as to principal and interest by the United States government. At best, the obligations of these GSEs have implicit and informal backing, as any member of Congress will tell you. And simply taking a failing institution into conservatorship doesn't confer government backing to its debt. In fact, the stopgap measure enacted by Congress during the crisis only provides temporary backing for the obligations of Fannie and Freddie maturing by the end of 2012. So very simply, the Fed broke the law by buying Fannie and Freddie's debt. Well, here's another one. In 2008, the Federal Reserve created a set of off-balance sheet shell companies called Maiden Lane to buy undesirable long-term assets of Bear Stearns and other financial companies, justifying purchases by appealing to Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act. But if you actually read Section 13, it is clear that under the law, discounting means, as it has always meant, providing short-term liquidity by essentially providing a check-cashing service for obligations that are short-dated, well-collateralized, and promptly collectible. The Fed's creation of the Maiden Lane companies to purchase bad assets was and remains illegal under the language and intent of the Federal Reserve Act. It was the duty of Congress to oppose this and confront the Federal Reserve with breaking the law. As always, it did nothing. Never forget, the Federal Reserve exists at the pleasure of Congress. Congress could abolish it at any time and for any reason. They already did so in the case of two other central banks in the United States' history. So there you go. All right. We have Peter in Jersey City who wants to talk about the possibility of a controlled inflation to prevent collapse. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Hey, good morning, Richard. I think maybe the screener might have misunderstood me. I was wondering whether it had ever been feasible in history to try a controlled deflation, whether it's part of von Mises's theories or any other major economist. And by that I mean, since in all major businesses, every business's major expense are someone else's prices, if the government had the political will to go to major corporations and demand they lower their prices, and when they squawk at the idea, guarantee or encourage that you'll find a way to help them lower their expenses proportionately, and do that with every major business. Since we're headed for default anyway, is there any way to make that a soft landing through a kind of controlled deflation? And then to bring a large amount of the fiat money that was printed back out of circulation.
No, Peter, you really can't do that. You can't do that because you can't have government intervening in the free market in that way. You know, you need to have faith in the market. The market will always take prices to their correct levels, given time and given the ability to act unfettered and unconstrained by government. You see, unfortunately, what happened in the 1990s is that the government intervened. It kept interest rates low, courtesy of the execrable Alan Greenspan, and it gave loans to people for purposes for which bank loaning was never intended. So therefore, you had an artificial increase in prices. You had an artificial boom, which, of course, turned into a bust, which, by the way, Mises would have approved of. But you can't compound the error by saying, oh, okay, well, prices went too high, and therefore, you know, government needs to lean on business to lower prices. Trust me and trust the market, Peter. Prices will go down of their own accord. They are going down as we speak. Prices are falling. You know, all this business about how inflation was going to take over, do you remember? One show after another, week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out. No, we are not in an inflationary environment. We are in a deflation. That is exactly what the market is doing right now. It's telling the government, it's telling business, sorry, your prices are too high. They are going to go lower. And if you start interfering with that process, all you do is create yet more trouble because you create more imbalances in the economy. And that, in turn, brings more businesses to their knees. I mean, enough businesses are going to be brought to their knees through the incompetent decrees of government as it is. We shouldn't want to compound the error. Let things happen according to the plan, and the markets sort out the economy. They always do, and they always will, because that's the nature of markets in a free economy. Now, I agree it's not a free economy right now. I agree entirely with anybody who says this is entirely, you know, government-controlled, government-manipulated. That is true. But look what happens when you try to control the manipulator. Look what happened when the Fed got involved with QE2. It was a disaster. Nothing has changed. Things have got worse. More debt has been created by QE2. And now we have an additional nightmare to have to contend with that we wouldn't have had if the government hadn't got involved. So no, the cry has to be government stays out of these things and just doesn't do anything, as was the case in 1920-21, where the potential depression was far worse than it ever was in 29-30. But the president left it alone, for which he was rewarded with being named one of the United States' worst presidents in history. Be that as it may, he left things alone, things turned round, and we have what's finally come known to be the Roaring Twenties. So unless you have any very good argument against that, Peter, I would suggest that that's where we need to go this time around.
Yeah, my only thought is, with the world is as interconnected as it is, unavoidably or not, to have everybody see those interconnections, including, I'm not just talking about the biggest businesses, I'm talking about across the board and the labor force, in the sense that everybody's price, once you can convince people to ask for less, labor to ask for less, businesses to ask for less, you can also entice them with the idea that if their expenses can be lowered, there's no real justification for allowing prices to remain high. And I do agree with you, if it can be moved in that direction, then you can just leave the market alone and it would self-adjust. I was just thinking in terms of a soft landing rather than the inevitable crash it looks like we face.
Well, you know, there's consequences to everything in life, Peter. Unfortunately, we haven't had enough consequences to injudicious spending and injudicious manipulation of prices on the upside. And therefore, the consequences are just going to be that much greater. Prices are going to have to fall, and they'll fall in their own way, whether government gets involved or not. I mean, the only meeting point that I think you and I have in that regard, frankly, is that the end result is going to be the same, whether, you know, initiated by government or by business and by, you know, the forces of supply and demand. And it's interesting what you say. I mean, it's definitely a philosophy which is followed by people in certain situations, not, of course, by governments and business. Governments, because that doesn't get them reelected, of course, and business because they think that their profit margins are going to drop What they don't realize is that either their profit margins drop or they drop themselves. I mean, they drop out of existence, which, of course, is what we're seeing, and it's going to happen again. And we just saw today the figures out for spending, which were much, much better than expected until you subtract the auto expenses, auto expenditures, and then, of course, you find that spending wasn't that great, and you got General Motors, a company with no money and no prospects, again, back in the market, offering, 72-month 0% financing. I mean, it's madness of the first degree, but that's how human beings are. They apparently have to learn the hard way. What can I tell you?
One more point, and I never thought I'd be giving the wake-up call advice, but you were decrying the lack of time you have to get to every subject. This might be a concrete suggestion that might work for the show. Had you given thought to making either the archives or RM at GFAWD, had you ever thought of trying to make them interactive, a kind of electronic answering machine so that people can call in and those comments and feedback and amplification and clarification on questions can be stitched together into a kind of a dialogue that goes beyond the 2 hours and other listeners can have access to that so it becomes a free-ranging conversation where you're only, in a sense, the nominal moderator, and that allows people, a la the New Brunswick group, and even on the Internet and through Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design and PRN to talk to each other with your show as the focus.
That's a very... I had never heard of anything like that. Fascinating idea, absolutely fascinating, and I would certainly be amenable to talking about that. Peter, what I'd like you to do, I'm actually very intrigued by that concept. Would you mind calling Matt, our engineer, and just running that idea by him? I mean, I know he's listening to the show. He's probably just heard what you had to say. But if you thought that you had some kind of technological input into this kind of thing, I'm sure he'd be interested to hear about it. But it's certainly something that I think is a very interesting concept. Yes, I would be very much in favor of something like that. When you first started to talk, I thought, well, of course, people can always get in touch with me by email, and I'm perfectly happy to answer anybody's email. I do, you know, try to get through everybody's emails either on the show or, in person. In fact, I hope I get through to everybody. And if anybody never gets an answer to their email, please do give it a couple of weeks for me to actually get to the emails online. And if that doesn't happen, then please ping me again and remind me, and I will definitely address your emails. But yes, that's a very, very good idea. Peter, thank you very much indeed.
It becomes like a verbal Facebook for the show. And then everyone who calls in, it's like they're going to your wall and saying, Richard, this is my opinion. And then becomes an interactive.
Why don't you have a chat with Matt about that? Would you, Peter, would you mind just calling this number again, you know, after the show and asking him what would be a convenient time to discuss it? I mean, Matt may be able to shed some light on this as well.
Okay. I will, Richard, and thanks for your input.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks very much for the idea. Thanks, Peter, for the call. I got an email from Steve Canero, which I would like to just read to you before we finish. Gosh, time goes so fast, it's just sad in the extreme. But here we go. It's, hi, Richard. Sounds like you just mentioned a solution concerning wages. 10 years ago, after reading an article on the then-current wage laws, I complained that the minimum wage was useless and not a livable wage, at least for one full-time job, that it should be raised, and an older fellow that was a programmer said I was right, but he believed there should be no minimum wage at all. We had a 20-minute debate, which I lost. For days, I thought about the points he made. It was my first interaction with a libertarian, and I have to admit, at least in America, he was right. The libertarian approach to wages challenges us all to have useful and in-demand skills. So I think you're right on with your solution to some of our business challenges. Not everyone can be a doctor or a programmer, though. Not everyone is that smart. There will still be poor folks. Perhaps the system in Sweden is superior, but that would never work here. I have to ask, though, if there are truly no solutions, why cover the protesters at all? Steve. Well, Steve, thank you for your thoughtful email there. Indeed, it's not that there are no solutions. It's just that I don't know what they are, and I may, as I say, reduce my coverage of the protesters dramatically because I don't want to deal in abstracts. I want to try to deal. I always try to make it a point on the wake-up call of dealing with the concepts which are identifiable and can be of some use to people in sort of orchestrating their lives. Yes, even in Singapore, there's no minimum wage. There is not a minimum wage here, and yet people are very prosperous. So do give that some thought, ladies and gentlemen, about really where we need to go with all this, because the answers are not easy, and certainly, I mean, take it from me and trust me, nobody in government has the slightest idea of how to handle what is clearly the world's most intractable economic and financial nightmare of all time. We just need grace and a willingness to thrive for the next 2 years, I'm afraid. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as always, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. It is the weekend. I hope you have a wonderful one. Get down and support your local Occupy Wall Street gathering if you can. And whatever you do, make it good. And I'll be back, same time, same place, on Monday. Take care. Bye-bye for now.